I'm going to be talking today about error budgets and how we use them to help speed execution. And so one of the things I want to get out, you know, in the front here is that this is just one framework for managing risk, error budgets. And there are many other frameworks that may work better, but this one has proved useful at Google, and we've used it, we've experimented with it, we've tried lots of different things, and so what I want to do is present it as a framework to this group and actually invite you to join in a conversation with each other and with me about, you know, whether and how you can use error budgets in your environments. In some companies, you know, it's going to be a slam dunk. Companies that look a lot like Google, you know, have sophisticated SRE teams, have been doing this for a long time. This should be, you know, sort of very straightforward. But in other places, it might be a little more challenging, interesting. And so, you know, having those conversations, I think, will be really useful, and is sort of the point of this session. All right, so. Conversation. I'll spend about 15 minutes going through the error budgets as a framework, and then we'll break into groups just in with the folks around you to have a conversation, and then we'll have time to report back interesting parts of those conversations and Q&A at the end. So there are lots of questions about error budgets. What are they? How do they work? Et cetera. But first, I think we need to take a little journey through SLAs and metrics just to make sure that we're all on the same page, that we're all talking about the same thing. So what are SLAs? SLAs are essentially a way of quantifying risk. And they can be very complicated. They could cover lots of different metrics. They could apply at many different levels in the stack. But I think a simplifying assumption that can be applied really usefully is to think of SLAs as primarily a way of quantifying or measuring unplanned downtime. So often when we talk about SLAs, we're talking about system uptime, right? So availability as measured in uptime over uptime plus downtime. In a lot of the environments that we run, you know, this is not that meaningful. Global outages are really not typical, and so, you know, we're serving some ads somewhere at all times, right? So instead, what we use is we use a yield-based metric that I think a lot of folks here are going to be familiar with, and that is, you know, we calculate our availability as a request success rate. So you look at availability as the successful request over the total request. And defining SLA in this way makes it easier to define and measure an error budget, and so that's, you know, the way that I'll be using it here. So, you know, just as a concrete example, if you have a system that's designed to be 99.99% reliable and you're talking about it in terms of uptime, then in a year that system can be down for approximately 52 minutes and still be within its SLA. Using that sort of in a request success rate, you would say, you know, if I have a system that serves 2.5 million requests in a given day with a similar 99.99% availability, I could serve errors for 250 requests in that day and still be within the SLA. All right, so where did error budgets come from? So, you know, roll back to about 2006. At that time, I had just moved over to one of the ad serving teams, and we rolled out a brand new system for serving AdSense ads. And if you're not familiar with AdSense ads, they're the ads that are embedded on other people's web pages. So maybe you're the New York Times, and you have a page with a story, and there's a little spot for an ad. You embed a bit of JavaScript. At page render time, the JavaScript calls out to Google servers. We look at what's on the page and choose ads that actually match the content to the page. And so, you know, initially we didn't know if it would be how successful it would be. We got it out into the market and we were reusing the ad serving technology. Over time, we realized that we could actually do a much better job if we changed it to use the search infrastructure. And so in 2006, we rolled it out using the search infrastructure, and it was the disaster you expect it to be. You know, it was like unstable and it crashed and there was, you know, corruption. We had trouble loading ads. You know, the updates took a long time. And, you know, we were measuring the number of pages we got in page rotations in hundreds rather than in sort of dozens. And it was not really sustainable. And we had a lot of trouble just hitting our SLA. So fast forward 3 years, and we had done a lot of engineering work. The development team and the SREs working together. We had a system that was stable. It was much more efficient. It performed well. When it was overloaded, it didn't fall over. It sort of did less work. And then, you know, when it was returned to its regular load level, you know, it actually didn't require humans to recover. And we found ourselves in a situation where we were really consistently exceeding our SLA target. You know, we felt like the system was performing well, and maybe it was a little too well. And by that I mean that we were exceeding the SLA, and we were leaving an opportunity on the table. So what could we have done instead of exceeding our SLA? Well, we could have been moving faster. We could have pushed code more quickly with less QA. We could have rolled out system configuration changes faster. We could have improved the quality of life for our engineers even further, lower pager levels, you know, higher response times, or we could have run the system hotter, you know, provision less excess resources to serve the same workload. I mean, in short, what we could have been doing is we could have been taking more risks. And this was the big aha moment for me. And it was that the SLA target is not just a minimum threshold, but it's also a maximum threshold. You know, our goal is not to make systems that are 100% reliable, they're to make systems that are as reliable as necessary and no more reliable. Now, I imagine some of you are saying, you know, hang on, you know, aren't all failures bad? Like, how can we serve failures sort of knowingly? But the reality is that, you know, all failures are usually not bad. If you are building a diagnostic device, a medical device, you know, keeping people alive, taking people on a space trip, you know, maybe you're building a system for 100% reliability, and there are a whole bunch of techniques for sort of working in that environment. For most of the people in this room, that's not your environment, right? We set our targets at 3.9s or 3.95 availability, and you know, we can move ourselves on this continuum from less reliable to more reliable by adding additional cost, right? So we engineer to a higher degree, we buy additional redundant hardware, we provision for less utilization. There are any number of ways. And so, you know, essentially SLAs and where they're set is a cost-benefit trade-off. And so this you know, is the one of the essential part of the essential nature of what SLAs are. So, you know, that SLAs as a minimum and maximum threshold, what that means is that we've sort of met the business need at the SLA, and then above that, we can use to serve other needs. And so what we did was we started trying to figure out ways to take more thoughtful risks. So what does that mean? So going back to the example of AdSense, in 2009, we set up what we called a 1% cluster. So it was a cluster that was sized to handle 1% of traffic at global peak. And we ran it like any other cluster. We set it up to be monitored, to alert us. And we used it to move faster. We you know, automated the push of new code to that cluster on a regular basis, much more frequently than we were doing at the time to the rest of the ad systems. We tested new configurations there, and you know, if it broke, that was okay. We would generate a page. We would fail over the traffic. At worst, we had sort of failed 1% of our requests if we happened to be at peak for the period of time that it took for us to sort of respond in our normal course to being paged by the system. And so the risk was sort of very bounded. You could say, you know, like, I know that our average page response time, our average drain, you know, failover time is 15 minutes, okay? So if I was at peak and that was 1% of traffic, I could calculate how many requests would fail and you know, look at what the effect on the SLA would be and say, you know, the maximum effect I would expect from a failure of this sort falls within the bounds and will still hit our SLA. So what this means is that the error budget, you know, is the headroom you have above your SLA. And by defining it in this way, we actually end up with taking a quantitative approach to managing risk. So the error budget is your measured availability minus your SLA target. So it's what you have left over when you're over and above the performance that you've guaranteed for the system. And the framing is really useful because it's you know quantifiable, and it allows us to perform the normal tasks that we do as engineers to measure, analyze, improve, and sort of once you've got that track record, you can start to depend on having access to do other things. So error budgets as a framework turned out to be very generically useful. So they're not just useful for low latency serving systems like AdSense. They're also useful at the infrastructure layer or for batch-oriented pipelines. And maybe the metrics that you use to measure your SLA are different, but the framework still holds. And it's also a useful tool for managing an engineering investment. So you have a system, rather than sort of gilding the lily and making it better and better and better, you sort of say like, okay, we've sort of hit the target that we want to hit for the system, and we can reassign the engineering resources that we would take, you know, to make this system better and put it on something else for a while. So there are three things you need to use an error budget. You know, one, you need to know what your SLA threshold is. Two, you need to be able to measure your performance. And three, you need to consistently exceed performance against that metric, against the SLA threshold. So, to provide a concrete example of how this may be generally useful, take the case of you know an interactive web application serving HTTP to end users over the internet. What I would suggest is you choose a reasonable but perhaps arbitrary metric as your threshold to get started. So you know in this example we might say our external SLA, the one we sort of want to guarantee to our end users, is 3 nines. And to meet that and have a little wiggle room, maybe we try to run the system to 3.95 of availability. The errors that we count are 500s. I mean, are there other errors? Sure, definitely. Maybe high latency events should be counted as errors over some threshold. But for simplicity, you know, let's call 500s errors. And then the measurement method is pretty simple. You grab the logs, you count up the requests, you count up the failures, and you calculate your performance against the SLA. If you consistently meet it, then you have a error budget to reinvest. So to summarize, this is the stuff that I just ran through quickly. And you know, it's a tool for managing risk, performance headroom over your SLA, you need three things, and it's a way to unlock SRE's ability to take thoughtful risks. So any questions on this before we break into groups for discussion? And if you ask a question, please use the mic. Okay, it's a fairly straightforward framework. So what I'd like to do now, show the questions, and Benoit is going to, has agreed to help me. I'd like to sort of, if you could grab the mic there. This is the sort of discussion that I'm imagining that we can have in the smaller group. So we could just run through the first few questions here. So is that
hello?
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So Benoit, what project would you like to talk about?
So I used to work with a company that had a recommendation engine that was also backed by ads. And so we can talk about like the backend system, having a similar kind of infrastructure than the one you run at Google with distributed databases, distributed search engine, that sort of stuff, and also like the same kind of SLA framework that you speak of.
Okay. Did you have a particular metric that you used for measuring availability or measuring the SLA?
So as usual, you have SLAs on availability and latency. So like that's what you were saying earlier. You have like error rates on how many requests succeeded versus how many failed, and if a request succeeds beyond a certain time, then it's also considered as a failure. So,
is there a trade-off you can make in exchange for lowering the SLA or lowering the performance against the metric?
So typically how those backend systems are built is that you have your user-facing backend systems that tend to have more stringent SLA requirements, like your user-facing HBase cluster, your user-facing Elasticsearch cluster, and those need to be, you know, really fast and always on. And then you have your other infrastructure for your batch systems where your SLA is perhaps less stringent and where you care about other metrics like having more throughput than lower latency, for instance.
Yep.
And so you kind of have to divide your backend systems into those two classes, you know, the user-facing, highly available, low latency backend systems versus the batch-oriented backend systems.
So that's a perfect example, right? You're taking your workload and you're saying, you know, like I can look at it one in this way and the other in this way. And I imagine you engineer the systems differently, the low latency serving systems versus the batch.
Right, of course, you make different trade-offs, right? Like in the user-facing service, you would tend to maybe flush things more frequently, which means that at high throughput, then the cost of flushing to disk would be more expensive. So you have to take, you know, more capacity for the same amount of requests per second,
right.
Stuff like that. And so I guess, you know, like part of what you speak of here means that, you know, for us, when you build a cluster and you say, okay, this cluster is going to be a user-facing cluster, so it's very latency sensitive, so I'm going to tune it this way, then you don't really have, I mean, it's kind of hard to say, to create room for experimenting with configuring like part of the cluster differently, because generally it's all uses the same configuration.
Right.
And like what you're saying here is, you know, maybe we're going to spin up another smaller instance of the service that's going to be configured differently or running a different version of the software.
Right.
And we're going to take some more risk by, you know, trying out something else, and maybe that's not going to work out so well, but maybe it will, and we learn something in the process.
Right.
And so,
For the batch-oriented clusters, also you can build them smaller, you can run them hotter, you can actually end up with a much lower cost because you don't have to service both workloads. Okay, thank you very much. There are more questions, but I want to give us time to talk. So just grab the people around you, and the questions are up here. I'll walk around. It would be great if you could talk about, you know, how and if you could use Aero Budgets as a framework in your environment. And we'll come back in about 20 minutes. All right, folks, if you could wrap up the conversations. Thank you. So I circulated around a bit, and there were a lot of really good conversations. What I'd like to do now is get folks who came up with good ideas or good questions to come up to the mic and sort of share with everyone some of the stuff that you talked about. You could do that now, if anyone is willing to talk.
Okay, I'm back.
Thanks, Benoit.
So I think one of the questions that came up in our little group over here was, how do you define this 1%, right? Like, I mean, in your example, it was 1%, but like, I guess in your case, because you have a large infrastructure, you can say, okay, I'm going to just build a smaller replica of this infrastructure and send 1% of the traffic to it. But if you have a service that's more like user-centric, for instance, is
Absolutely.
It 1% of the users or 1% of the queries across all the users? Or, you know, like
absolutely, yeah. This came up in a discussion with the team over there as well. The ad system is nice in that we don't have at least at Google, we don't have a strong sense of the users. We just have sort of cookies, right? And so you could look at the traffic and sort of just look at cookies, or you can sort of it's an undifferentiated stream of traffic. So I've since moved from ads into social. So if you look at photos, for example, if you're choosing 1% of users, it's the 1% of unlucky users, right? Like, and you don't want to do that. So certain systems provide degrees of flexibility in one dimension or another. So not all remedies will work for all different kinds of systems. You have to think about, you know, how to deploy the risk given the constraints of the system that you have.
So it's not really a question, But we talked about the supporting structures, and I think one of the things that we realized is really needed for that is have a system to measure that, report on that, because like measuring by itself, it doesn't really help us, and also correlate the loss of error budget with a certain launch. Like, so that when we actually run experiment, we can actually say, okay, well, this consumed 50% of our error budget.
Right.
Are we gonna go or are we gonna roll back, right?
Yeah, in the case where you're spending your error budget in particular releases, it could be very useful to do that. Alternatively, you can just sort of spend it over a sort of peanut butter it across the whole quarter or the whole month or whatever it is by just increasing the rate of change and seeing smaller failures in more limited circumstances.
And the second thing that came up was like communication. If you're an engineering team, an SRE team, we need to have like a good balance of, hey, engineers, we have this error budget. Go and spend it on whatever you like, because people are going to be averse to the idea of we are free to break stuff. But we also need the counterbalance of actually saying, and now we've spent it all, we need to roll back. Right?
So absolutely.
Communication between the two parts.
Absolutely. I said this in one of the groups too, that I feel like in really well-run services, the development team and the SRE team are co-owners of the service. And working together, they're sort of each showing up with their own particular strengths around engineering and delivering that service together to end users. And so in a case where you have a strong dialogue, a good dialogue between the sides, then it tends to be much easier to make the trade-off, figure out whether you make the trade-offs on the operational side, on the engineering side, on the moving fast side. You know, that communication is really critical. Absolutely.
Dave? I have a question. Somewhat of how you do it, since you're seem to be the leader in error budgets, but one of the problems we have is you do self-reported SLAs or externally reported SLAs. For a service-oriented architecture, generally the only useful measure of is that service working is the major service that relies on that service saying it's down or not. And there's other obviously many reasons why A can't talk to B, but B itself often has a really shitty idea of how good it is because large parts of it may be down and reporting no metrics at all.
Absolutely. So the pattern that I've seen repeat itself is that you start by measuring what's easy to measure, you know, and that's usually a sort of the server side. What's my view of my own performance? And then over time, you sort of can increase the sophistication of your measure. You can take into account the client side view of your performance as well. And so, you know, at Google, we have the advantage of having a bunch of different services, and so we can actually test the availability of one service from another. So you can do things like, you know, measure the background rate of error rate of the internet, of different ISPs, of IPv6 versus IPv4, and sort of factor that into what level of service you want. You know, this is a case where if you have access to the clients, then, you know, by all means, that tends to be a more difficult proposition than having access to the server-side logs. Ultimately, what you need is it depends on sort of the service you're offering and whether that meets the needs of the business or not.
For the purposes of like, hey, you're over or under your error budget, and you just had an incident that was very externally visible to that service, but internally they said, hey, I thought it was okay. I thought
right.
My SLA was
yep.
98, and everybody else says, no, it's 90, who wins?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the, you know, one continuing problem is that you have to reckon with is that people end up becoming dependent on the service that you offer, not the service that you've guaranteed to offer. And we see this pattern repeated all over the place, right? So, you know, like I deliver 99.9% availability for a service, but I guarantee only 99.9%. So it is the customer's responsibility to make sure that they can actually perform well in the face of you actually delivering your SLA. It can help if you test it, you know, like if you intentionally inject faults in to meet your SLA for some periods of time or for certain, you know, portions of your user base so that you can sort of validate the assumptions. And we're starting to do that more, and I think it's a really interesting direction of inquiry that will help us sort of firm stuff up. In the end, though, you know, like, I always appeal to the greater good and say, like, you know, yes, I screwed up. I depend on you 99.99% of the time instead of 99.9% of the time. But, you know, this was a really sucky experience for the end users. And so can we either renegotiate that SLA or can you stop spending your air budget and I will do the engineering needed to sort of live within my means? But, you know, we're all ultimately working together. Yep.
So do you feel like there's a best practice for what happens when you blow through your SLA in a hurry all of a sudden?
There are a bunch of different techniques that you can use here. So when you're not hitting your SLA, you know, one of the key things with an air budget, I think, is actually choosing bounded risk. You know, so something that's easily reversible, something that that is easy to measure and easy to understand sort of the effects of. And so, you know, try to make sure that you're not opening yourself up to sort of arbitrary levels of risk. You may be in a situation where you've blown through your air budget either because the you know, like, your risk was too great or because the underlying system just didn't perform this quarter as it did the last quarter. And so then the standard approaches apply, you know, freezing changes, reducing the rate of change, partitioning workloads. These are all sort of common techniques for sort of stopping the bleeding, and then investing in more engineering around overload protection and cascading failure and, you know, all the things that are listed there. But those are sort of, is that what you were asking?
Well, I was looking at a more specific instance where something that is surprising to you as opposed to just general bad practices has caused you to blow through your budget. And so you do whatever remediation is called for, and then, you know, what do you want people to do next? Do you think that it's the best practice to essentially just reset your counters and restart your work period, or do you?
The way I think about it is that, you know, error budgets are not a right, they're sort of an earned. That you earn them over time, and you earn them through consistent good performance over your SLA. So if I have a system under management that we've sort of screwed up, we've missed our SLA target for that quarter, then, you know, we're probably not going to try to spend an error budget that doesn't really exist the next quarter. We want to sort of make sure that we get back to the performance over and above our SLA before we start taking those additional risks again.
So if you did this to yourself in the first week, you would release zero features that quarter?
No, I would go back to sort of a more typical stance where, you know, if you imagine that you take a certain level of risk to get to your SLA, mm-hmm. And you've then, you know, assessed that your risk actually, that your risk profile got you above your SLA, well, you know, go back to the prior risk profile. So I don't think you want to freeze things. In our business, you know, you can't really freeze things forever, but you can sort of say, like, we'll take more prudent steps to reduce our risk for the remainder of the period and until we sort of get back to good performance on a consistent basis.
All right, fair enough.
Hi, so I've heard like a lot of talk about error budgets for like mitigating like between risk and consumer or production, like production numbers. But have you applied them or thought about applying them to like internal numbers for tracking things like exceptions or alerts or anything like that?
And how would that work? How would you imagine that would work?
So like for instance, a particular team ships something that's like throwing a bunch of exceptions, but isn't actually noticeably affecting customers.
I like to focus on the end user visible effects or the customer visible effects. You know, people can engineer stuff. They're throwing exceptions, and maybe those are a problem for the logging system. But, you know,
like just sort of the under the concept that, like, you know, an exception here or there is fine, an alert here or there is fine. But these are sort of indicating that, like, warning signs or check engine lights that could eventually lead to these production problems, right? So like heading it off internally, making sure that you're keeping, you have good alerting setup and good trigger setup, but trying to keep it so they're not going off. And like you're tracking exceptions, but trying to make sure that they're not happening so that you're preventing it sort of at the source.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm having trouble applying the idea of an error budget to this other than saying that, you know, like these things are good to track, especially if they prove over time to be good indicators of problems to come, then setting up sort of non-urgent alerts to take care of them and nip them in the bud, I think is a really good approach.
Cool. Thank you.
As you're walking up, someone asked about measurement and how you measure it, especially in high volume systems. At Google, we employ a bunch of different ways of measuring our SLA. You know, some teams are able to just use their monitoring system, depending on the sort of polling interval and calculation, to provide a reasonable assessment of what their performance against SLA is. The most common method, I'd say, is sort of counting log entries and directly counting the yield. For certain systems, we use either active probing or statistical analysis. We sort of take a population of the requests and look at their performance and use that to make an assessment of what our performance versus the SLA is, or of the against the SLA is, yeah.
So we've gotten started with error budgeting, and one of the things we found was, in order to start getting adoption, was the concept of a falling cap. Essentially, start with 1 million exceptions per day as you're acceptable and slowly reduce that. That's an example. What other thoughts do you have on how to get started with it? What are good ideas, good practices?
So what are you trying to accomplish with that quota? Are those end user visible problems that you're sort of in, you start with 1 million a day and you sort of walk down from there, or?
That would be an example. Another one would be, you know, latency of a call. It starts at 250 milliseconds is your SLA, and you want to drive it down to 100 over the next year. So having a falling cap, so you don't have to drop it to that in a day, but you know, now it's 250, next month it's going to be 220, and working your way down.
It sounds like what you're describing are ways or techniques that you might use to drive a tightening of SLA targets.
Right, because you know, if we say developers we want to be at 100 milliseconds, they're going to freak out maybe about it. So it's kind of more the question is, how do you maybe help get developers to buy into it and understand it as an ally and not an opposition?
Yeah, I would say that this is more a question of, you know, how do you set the right SLA? And it's an interesting and difficult question, but, you know, ultimately what I always go back to is, what is the benefit to the business? What does the business need? Like, is the business asking you to drive that latency target down? Is it important for the users of that product directly? What, you know, like, does it tie to revenue? There are a whole bunch of questions you can ask that sort of provide the motivation. And, you know, the exercise is really about, you know, understanding the business needs and then building a coalition with the development team to work together to agree on a target and then work together to hit that target. SLAs, you know, like sometimes you have to put a stake in the ground and say, we're going to start measuring, but they work best when they're signed off on by, you know, the dev team, the SRE team, and the product owners, so that everybody is aligned about what's actually important and what, you know, so what performance we need to deliver to the end users.
Cool. Thank you.
The last comment before I end this is that a theme that came up when I was walking around is that there is a persistent belief by business side owners that actually they want 100% availability. And, you know, this is perhaps, you know, like the first problem you need to counter. And that is that, you know, as I said before, it's really SLA setting is a cost-benefit exercise. And so, you know, I'd recommend that you sort of walk them back from that and say, you know, like, we've engineered the system to, say, 3 nines of reliability. This is the given cost. We could make it 4 nines of reliability for 2x, 3x, 5x the cost, and sort of lay out, like, the price point that they would have to pay, the cost that they would have to pay to get the additional levels of reliability. But, you know, educating them on the fact that, like, even if you're running a telco, you're probably not going to get 5 nines, right? So that I think is job number one. So thank you very much for coming to this session and for the great conversations. And I appreciate it. And I'm happy to answer any additional questions up here. But thank you very much.